Hey, Collaborist. I'm Ben Leroy.
And I'm Jason Buchholz.
Welcome to Collaboracast. How you doing, Jay?
I'm doing all right. How about you?
Doing all right. After our last discussion, I said that softball practice was coming up. We had a game. We had a practice game to let the umpires get a little live action testing of their skills, introducing new umpires to the Umpire Secret Society. And I will say that as an old man, I still went 2 for 2, did not commit any errors. And though I felt both slow and cold, it was a semi-enjoyable experience.
Excellent. Did you get those new umps something to, did you break them in, kick some dirt on some shoes?
Yeah, I definitely had the old Sparky Anderson, Earl Weaver meltdown, started doing all that, turned the hat backwards, started yelling, screaming. Good. Because there is nothing more consequential than City League softball games. Definitely definitely a thing to really get worked up about. My experience.
Yelling at umps has always yielded such productive results, too, I've found.
It really has.
So for this segment, it's the old man sporting news. I went out and rejoined my soccer team last night for, I think, my second game in 5 years. Often they play late at night and I just can't do that anymore. But last night they had a game at 8, which seemed reasonable. So I went down and got on the field, and you know what I forgot about with soccer?
Cardio.
Exactly. The running. Out there. I was like,
I started having an asthma attack when you just were talking about playing soccer. So yeah, I get it.
It's like, but people just, oh, now I got to go over there. I think I managed about 10 minutes and then subbed out and then stretched for another 20 minutes and then drank water at halftime. And then I got back out there and I had a solid 10, 15 minutes to start the second half. These are 25 minute halves, I should say. So
I think it's important to point out too, that this isn't like me going out and playing soccer. Like, you actually played a lot of soccer. Like you.
I did. Not well, but very enthusiastically. And it was good. These are people that I haven't seen in a long time. So it was good to catch up and just plug myself back into that community, and actually did all right. Interestingly, I'm working with a client now, helping her to write a book, and she was a very high level soccer player. So I'm doing some ghost writing for her and kind of mentally inhabiting the world of this very committed young woman. And I played well last night. I think there's something to that.
It's a mindset. And we should talk about that in a future episode, how important it is for a ghostwriter to be able to get into the person that they're writing about or from whom perspective they're writing from. We should talk about that, because that is both something that Collaborist offers, ghostwriting, but it's a skill set that requires a couple of things, writing only being one of them. You really have to be able to remove your own brain and put in somebody else's brain, or house both brains in the same body.
It's a bit like acting in some ways.
Speaking of doing two things at once, we have a guest on the podcast today. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Yes. Today's guest is Wendy Levinson. She is my agent at the Harvey Klinger Agency in New York City. It was really nice to sit down and chat with her. I've had, primarily email exchanges with her over the last few years, and they've primarily been assuring her that I'm continuing to make progress on the project that she's waiting for. She's been delightfully patient and gracious, and it was really nice to sit down and connect with her via Zoom, obviously. Really envied her background of books. If you have a choice between listening to this or seeing it on our YouTube channel, I'd encourage you to at least take a peek if you're into bookshelves. I subscribe to various Instagram feeds of just libraries and bookshelves. So if you're that level of nerdiness, then do take a peek at Wendy's not digital background, her very real analog bookshelf background. But it was a really interesting conversation. I learned a lot myself about, I have had a vague understanding of what agents do, more than a vague understanding, but to just hear her talk about a day in the life and what she's looking for and how she finds it. And then towards the end of the conversation, she gets into some practical feedback, some practical advice on query letters and how to approach agents and what to say to them. And that's something that we've been talking about here on this podcast a lot, is the query letter review. So you can hear it straight from Wendy if you hang around for the latter part of the interview. But Vince, can you say a little bit about the query letter reviews that we are doing?
Yeah. And this is a reminder that the plan is for not this week's episode, but next week's episode, Jason and I are going to be going over some listener submitted query letters to give real-time feedback about what works and what doesn't work for us as individual readers, making sure that things are the way they should be. The things that should be included are included. There's also already some content on our YouTube page where I've done a couple of breakdowns of query letters. This time, Jason's going to be involved too, and we're going to take the lessons that we have from our own experience, but also apply what Jason and Wendy talk about. And, I think that instead of me going on endlessly, we should just get into that interview with you and Wendy.
Let's do it. Here's Wendy Levinson. Well, thank you very much for joining me.
So happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. Could I have you just introduce yourself to our listeners, you and Harvey Klinger?
Absolutely. I'm Wendy Levinson. I am a literary agent at the Harvey Klinger Agency, which is based in New York City. We have a handful of agents who work there. And I have been there for almost 20 years at this point. But it's a great group of agents, and I'm delighted to talk to you about agenting, the process, anything and everything.
All right. Well, I really appreciate it. Thanks for joining me. I have questions about all of the above, especially the anything and everything part. But I'd like to first, well, you and I have been working together for a few years now, and by working, it's mostly been you waiting around for me to finish my novel, which I very much appreciate your patience and feedback. But I don't know a whole lot about who you are and how you got into this and what your kind of background is. So I do want to get into some of the practicalities and do's and don'ts and things for some of our listeners who might be aspiring. But before we get into that, I'd just love to learn a little more about who you are and how you got into this.
Absolutely. So I was an English major at Amherst College, and I got my start on the editorial side of publishing. First at St. Martin's Press, and then at HarperCollins Publishers, where I worked assisting the editor-in-chief. And then I was sort of lured into book scouting in the world of television and film. At that time, a lot of these movie studios were opening up offices in New York City, and there was a real value placed in knowing what was getting onto editors' desks, what they were reading, what the hot books were. And there was
The studios wanted to know that?
The studios wanted to know that so they mm-hmm. could get a jump on books before they were released out into the marketplace. So because I had worked at a couple of different publishers at that point and had a pretty good contact base, I was asked to sort of join first Hearst Entertainment for their television division to be their book scout and bring them early looks at books that would eventually sell to publishers. It was a great gig because you read very broadly across, you know, many genres, and you were sort of very much on top of what the hot books were in the marketplace at the time. And I enjoyed it a lot. And then I went on to do similar work, but with more of a developmental orientation for a producer who had been very successful in his time and produced movies like Fatal Attraction and Kramer versus Kramer and The Accused and Bad News Bears. And he got a new production deal at Sony. And so I went to work with him developing literary adaptations and working with screenwriters, which was a terrific experience. But I realized after a time that I wasn't suited to Hollywood culture and living in Los Angeles. I'm a native New Yorker. So I came back to New York and kind of learned that the skills that I had developing screenplays were quite similar to those used by literary agents developing book projects and working creatively with writers. So I got my start at the Scott Waxman Agency, and then a couple of years later joined the Harvey Klinger Agency with a focus on literary fiction and narrative nonfiction.
And so you came, so you didn't want to get back into the publishing side of things. You found that you were enjoying the little different slot in the workflow.
That's right. I was really enjoying the process of not only discovering great talent and stories, but also just developing them at a very early stage in the process. I just found to be super exciting and satisfying. So, and there's also, I also enjoyed sort of, it's slightly more entrepreneurial in a way, being, you know, in a smaller agency and being out there in the world and sort of, you know, following your instincts and reaching out to journalists or short story writers. And I really enjoyed that freedom as well. So it just felt like a better fit than being in, you know, a big mainstream publisher at that time.
Tell me a little more about that process. So you were talking about reaching out to different people. So what are you, tell me about that reach out and what you're looking for and how things kind of, how you would cast your net to bring projects in and to begin to do that discovery process.
Sure thing. So clients come to me in all sorts of ways. First and foremost is certainly queries or unsolicited queries that come in. And then I also discover writers at writers' conferences that I attend regularly. I read literary journals regularly, and I will read a great story or a great nonfiction piece, and I will track down the email of an author and I will reach out to them.
Do you want to quickly plug some of your favorite journals?
Sure. So some of my favorite journals at the moment, Joyland, The Normal School, Plowshares, Catapult, Southern Review, Kenyon Review, The Pinch, Narrative. Those are sort of my favorites at the moment. I mean, there are so many wonderful journals and magazines out there, but those tend to be the journals that I read most consistently and have also successfully found and signed clients from. So it's just, you know, there's that too.
It's good to know. I find I'm kind of suffering from chronic journal overwhelm. I mean, I'll come across just wonderful things out there, but there are so many.
Yeah.
And it's just so much good stuff. It's such a landscape.
I agree. You know, it's such a cliche, but there just aren't enough hours in the day, right, to read all of the wonderful words in our world. But that's certainly an exciting way that I find clients as well, is through the journals. And then
so you reach out, you read a short story or something that you
that I feel passionately about, was transfixed by, and I will, you know, write a love letter, an email to an author and introducing myself and, you know, expressing interest in discussing further, reading further work.
Asking if they're working on, so you mostly represent like book length manuscripts though, or short story collections or all the above?
Book length manuscripts. I do represent some fiction writers who are working on their debut novel and have a collection sort of in hand, but it is easier to lead with a debut novel instead of it's can be very tricky to sell a collection, but it's wonderful to sell a debut novel and then either do a two book deal with a collection or sell the collection after the novel has been out in the world and found its readership. But yes, so I represent novelists, short story writers, journalists, anthropologists, activists, scientists, poets exploring new, different other nonfiction forms. That's what part of what I love about what I do. It's just, I'm never sure what I'm going to read that day or what query is going to come in that's going to be like, that's really going to grab me and I'm really going to connect with. And so it's like every day is a, you know, it's, I just don't know what I'm going to find. So it really helps get me out of bed in the morning for sure.
So does your day typically start off with reading? Is that your, walk me through a day in the life.
So it's certainly, it will start off, it's a combination of things. It's with catching up with whatever emails come in on the foreign side, because I'm the director of foreign rights at my agency, and they work, they're a few hours ahead of us. So in a typical day, I will start on and see what needs to be handled for the sales of all of our properties in foreign territories. And then sure, I will catch up with any client correspondence and I will read some queries, you know, in an ideal day. And then, you know, there are really exciting days that may start with finishing a manuscript that is fantastic that I'm super excited about and want to make an offer representation on. That's a really good day. Oftentimes in a day, I will have a Zoom meeting to discuss notes on a project that I'm developing with a client, either notes on the nonfiction side on a proposal or drafts of a revision of a novel. So most of my days will have a creative component to it, with giving editorial feedback. And there's always a portion of my day that is staying on top of whatever might be developing in the business of publishing. So reading Publishers Lunch, reading Publishers Weekly, Publishers Marketplace, reading the latest book deals that have been announced on Publishers Marketplace, talking with my colleagues, talking with editors. Lately in the pandemic, with so many people working from home or shifting to a hybrid model, our agency has been having meet and greets with publishers, with specific imprints. And that's been like a wonderful way to keep the connections going, even though we're not having lunches as much as we used to. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Online meet and greets, or they have kind of an open house Zoom kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. They're Zoom with, you know, the, a few editors from an imprint and all of, you know, our agency together talking about, our list of clients, their list of books, you know, where we can find connection and, what they're looking for. And that's always just, you know, wonderful and helpful. It helps us do our jobs. So I hope that gives you a pretty good sense of what a day in the life of an agent would look like, at least an agent at Harvey Klinger. So,
yeah, probably not. Similar functions, I would assume, across the board. So much of your work depends on those connections. I imagine that coming from a publishing background, you already had a built-in understanding of what editors are looking for. I guess as I learn more about the process of agenting, I'm imagining that it seems that, like, so as you're reading something, as you're reading a potential manuscript, you're thinking about not just is this good or not, do I love it, but you're thinking of specific people, specific outlets, and that all depends on your connections and your knowledge of what they're looking for.
Exactly.
So could you talk a little more about that and just maybe how you mentioned, you know, in the Zoom intros now, but so much of it used to just be in-person networking in New York City. And so how has that changed or impacted the way that you work or just your ability to do this?
Right. I mean, Zoom has been transformative in that way. And I feel like, you know, publishers will agree that everyone sort of adapted pretty quickly and we were able to pivot towards having these meet and greets over Zoom instead of in person. But certainly, knowing which editor to go to, the right publisher is informed by years of knowing all these editors and their acquisition history and what their tastes are and, you know, if they have children or not, or if they, you know, where they are, what phase they are in their life. There is certainly a thread of personal relationships, but then there's also just following deals that are posted in Publishers Marketplace. So you can very purposefully search for acquisition history for a given editor, and that will help inform a submission list as well. But it really though just starts with my connection to words on the page. If the voice is terrific in a manuscript that I'm considering, and if it has beautiful, you know, I look for beautiful language, for, you know, immersive, transporting qualities, you know, in fiction. I also really value interiority and an intimacy in the writing, but that can also have the potential to really resonate in a big way. And so I know fairly quickly when I'm really starting to get excited about something, and that passion is what will carry me through to, like, knowing then the names of editors will start coming to me. I know, this would be great for thus and such. Or I know she'd love this, the sense of place that is in this, that I love about this manuscript. So it really just starts with good writing, sort of gets the wheels in motion.
How often does it happen that you come across a manuscript that you really love, but just can't think? I mean, obviously, I'm sure there are times where you try to place things and it doesn't work out, as we writers know all too well. Yeah. But there must be times when you come across something that you really love, maybe in a new and unexpected way, and then just don't have an outlet for it or can't think of a place for it to go. Or are there ways to find that out? Like you were talking about searching through histories of acquisitions.
Right.
And then,
right. Well, certainly, there are some projects that I have taken on that have started, you know, with a real passion for what I'm reading, but perhaps that project isn't as obviously commercial or for all one of the big five mainstream publishers, but is really better suited for a smaller, independent, more sort of mission-oriented press. And so and maybe I don't have the depths of contacts at like a few of these smaller publishers. So that's an example of where I would dig or do a little more research and be sure that there were a healthy amount of publishers and editors and actively acquiring editors at those smaller imprints that I would feel confident in my ability to place such a project that wasn't obviously commercial. And my, so that's, I think that's an answer to your question.
Yes. Yeah. I'm thinking about, so you said that you've been doing this for 20 years and, you know, with, and you've been in, you know, with the detour to Hollywood, but it's been all, you know, it's been in the one place with all those connections. So I'm thinking about an aspiring agent listening to you and thinking about the depth of the contacts and the network and how difficult it must be starting out. To build those and to not have those. I would imagine that many agents do come from within the publishing world, sure, where they the connections first, and then
that's right. I mean, and there has been a fair amount of turnover of editors, becoming agents, editors starting their own editorial consulting companies. This has been happening for some time now. So, for an agent starting out, I mean, first and foremost, your colleagues at whatever agency you would land in would certainly help support you and share their contacts and make introductions on your behalf. And, editors also want to get to know you and what your taste is, because they, to a certain extent, compete to get your attention and your submission. So it's kind of a lovely system in that way, because editors are motivated to connect with you as well. And you know, it would certainly be harder, I think, to start out during the past, you know, 2.5 years when everyone's been working at home, as opposed to, you know, working in an office where those types of introductions can all just come more organically. You know, we at our agency, I mean, we certainly do whatever we can to share information and pool information about trends and editors and what they're looking for. And it's sort of like, we all pull that information. So I think an agent starting out would get a lot of that access to sort of the collective brain trust, if you will. So it wouldn't necessarily be as daunting as it might sound. And once you start putting your first couple few deals into Publishers Marketplace, you know, you'll start getting attention, and editors will reach out to a young agent and say, you know what, this is exactly the kind of book that I'd love to have on my list. And I want you to think about me for the next project that you handle that is in this vein. So please think of me, let's get together, let's connect. So that's how those types of connections start.
I was wondering how reciprocal that, I mean, so I, you know, my experience has all been from the writer's side, and there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of writers all clamoring to get the attention of agents and publishers. And the experience for most writers is they don't really find quite as much reciprocated as they might like, unfortunately. But you know, those are the statistics. Those are the numbers. That's just the reality given the number of book deals out there. So it's good to hear that at that stage, that once, you know, between the agents and the editors, there is that kind of mutual connection and cooperation and synergy.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier, I'm interested in hearing more about the sorts of things that you personally love and look for. You mentioned language and interiority are there. And if you want to mention certain projects by name, I know you've got a lot of different clients. I don't want to put you on the spot and ask you to play favorites, but if there are some projects, some things that you've had a hand in bringing into the world that you're particularly proud of for whatever reason,
sure.
I'd love to hear about sure. those and just your, you know, the mark that you would love to leave on the culture.
Absolutely. So in terms of, you know, the mark on the culture I'd like to make or contributions I'd like to make, and sort of what changes I've seen in the literary culture in the past couple few years. You know, it's been, of course, wonderful to see the raising up of underrepresented voices and writers in our world. And we certainly, this is a shift that we continue to see with many books selling to publishers and in the marketplace more broadly that are focused on race and gender, as well as books about climate change and the environment, recovered histories. And there's also been a real renaissance in poetry collections, which I think is likely due in no small part to Amanda Gorman, right? But you know, in this spirit, you know, I'm super excited about a book that I sold that will be coming out from Harper One, which is a division of HarperCollins Publishers this summer. And it's called May Tomorrow Be Awake on Poetry, Autism, and Our Neurodiverse Future by Chris Martin, who is a poet and an educator. And his book describes his sort of groundbreaking, pioneering approach to helping his non-speaking autistic students find their voices through writing poetry. And it's sort of the profound lessons that he learned and that we all can learn about neurodivergent voices. So that's one example. You know, also really excited about a book that of mine that I sold that came out in February from a different division of HarperCollins. And this book is called Walking the Bowl, a true story of murder and survival among the street children of Lusaka. And it was co-authored by a medical anthropologist, Chris Lockhart, and Daniel Malilo Chama, who is a former street child in Lusaka. And he's now getting his degree in social work. And it's this incredibly riveting, vibrant story of these young children living on the street whose lives become sort of inextricably caught up in a murder of a fellow street child. But it has this hopeful ending and it is unbelievably really about sort of human kindness and how one good deed passed on to another just can make a difference in the face of like overwhelming odds. Those are two examples of books where, you know, the extent that I can discover amazing stories like that or voices that maybe had been on the margin or had never really even been discovered, you know, can be centered in our culture. To the extent that I can keep doing that, you know, or bringing just moving, meaningful, powerful stories to the public, you know, I'd love to keep doing that. And I feel a lot of gratitude that I, you know, that I sort of have the role that I do, that I can sort of be in the position that I am. So I hope that gives you sort of a sense of, you know, not only the type of narratives that I have been connecting with, but, you know, but that have found homes in these wonderful publishers and then they're out in the world. And Walking the Bull was actually in a New York Times book review editor's choice pick. And, you know, the whole paper really got behind that book. So that was really exciting. Anyway.
Those both sound remarkable. I'll have to look for those. What strikes me about both of those is that they sound very, you know, you talked about the culture, the shifting culture and the impact, and they sound like they're very in tune with changing awareness. It's you know, these are projects that are, you know, not just sitting there in isolation. They're very connected to our changing awareness of, mm-hmm. you know, different sociological, educational, anthropological phenomena. So, just not a question, just a reflection and, yeah. and an observation.
Yeah. And, you know, again, just to sort of circle back to kind of where we've gone and like the process of aging, it's not like I set out like one day to like go find a narrative that will, you know, shed light on, you know, children in Africa. It's just, you know, it's just having, a connection to really beautifully, powerfully written stories that present themselves to me. And in that case, it was, you know, the author reached out to me and queried me. And, you know, so again, like I feel incredibly, you know, grateful that to have been on the receiving end of that narrative. And, you know, I hope that it will, have an impact and, can, you know, spread some awareness. You know, I, it's not that I don't work with just a set agenda, like I need this and that, but it's just a general openness. And certainly, you know, I always have in mind what the voices of various editors and what they would love to have on their lists. And, you know, and if there's a match, that's great. But,
great. Well, shifting over a little bit to the more practical side then for some listeners. So for the listeners who have not placed a beautiful short story in Plowshares yet, so for the, you know, like you said, the majority are going to be these queries. So what are the things that really stand out for you in a query letter? If you were to just provide some advice for aspiring authors, what are general best practices and things that you in particular gravitate towards?
Absolutely. In my opinion, a successful query letter will initially reflect some research that the writer's done into, you know, me or the agent they're approaching about what those agents' interests are, you know, where they've looked at the Harvey Klinger website and they've looked at my personal website. And so they are familiar perhaps with my wish list or, you know, books, some of my current clients. And so that would prompt them to reach out. That's always, I think, a good opening to a query. And then I look for a concise description about what the project is, what genre or category the writer is working in, along with word count. So like a work of literary fiction or a work of book club fiction or a work that bridges the literary commercial divide, some language to that effect that really shows the writer knows their category. And then pretty soon after that, you know, the quote unquote elevator pitch. In other words, like in 1 to 2 sentences saying what the book is, what it will do, and then having a brief synopsis that says in, you know, 4 to 8 sentences, you know, the beginning, middle, and end of the book. And then ending with a couple of comparative titles or comp titles. So, you know, with shades of Ann Patchett's The Dutch House meets Donna Tartt's The Secret History, or just, So something that shows, you know, the intended audience, and, you know, it helps the agent identify, you know, where this would fall on the bookshelf. And then the author bio is super important, along with any publishing credentials, previously published books, or any credits of a nonfiction piece in a journal, or a short story in a journal, work of poetry in a journal, inclusion in any anthologies, anything to that extent, because those credits will certainly help an agent then go on to sell the work to an editor. So that's a really important piece of the query letter too. And then finally, you know, it's super important for writers to read carefully the agency guidelines for submitting queries, because there are quirks and every agency is a little bit different. Like, for example, at the Harvey Klinger Agency, we asked for the first 5 pages of the manuscript to be pasted into the body of the email so that the sample pages come last after the query letter, and no attachments unless requested. And, you know, but we get attachments. So, you know, it's just shows a level of thoughtfulness and thoroughness on the writer's behalf. And, you know, little things like only approach one agent at a time at a given agency. And, you know, so that's sort of my, like, my checklist of things to be mindful of when crafting a query letter.
Querying 101 best practices.
Exactly.
What if you had to, what are a couple of big don'ts? What are the things that will make you immediately,
well,
whipping out the rejection form letter?
Well, in a category that I explicitly don't represent, like YA or children's, I don't, you know, I also, or, you know, prescriptive self-help books is just, it's an area in nonfiction that I just don't represent that. If there are attachments, because, you know, and there's so many viruses going around, you know, we really just don't like attachments unless we request them. So those are sort of the big no-nos. You know, also, if you, you know, be mindful of, you know, your word count. You know, I have received query letters that are describing a manuscript that's in close to 200,000 words, which is pretty long. So that signals something to the agent, right? Typically, you know, I'm speaking in very broad terms, but we like word counts to come in somewhere between the short end, like 50,000 to like the top 100,000, you know, that's sort of the sweet spot. That's a pretty big sweet spot, but
it's the most marketable zone there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are exceptions obviously, but that's the zone.
First time author. I think those exceptions seem like they come into play more once you've established yourself a bit.
Exactly. Exactly. But I, so that's, yeah, that's sort of, I can't really think of any sort of like warning, but those are the most common queries that I'll get that will, you know, tell me that, you know, it's not the right fit, or, you know.
Seems like mostly just a case of doing your homework and understanding, just reading the submission guidelines and understanding your genre and what you've got on your hands.
Right, right. And taking, you know, a few moments to look into the given agent you're reaching out to, if you can mention a client or a book or that the agent represented, I think that's meaningful too. You know, I understand that there's so many agents out there, and it is laborious to send out these queries, and that, you know, it can, some writers I think try to, you know, find some efficient lines to just going after the group of at once, but I think
the word is spamming. I think you can say it. It's spamming agents.
But I just you know, agents read their queries. I mean, we get clients from them all the time. So I think, you know, I mean, it's a great thing, but it also should be done with some care and thought.
Time and thought into it. All right. Well, thank you so much, Wendy.
It's a pleasure. Really
appreciate it. I won't take up any more of your time. You've got reading to do, I'm sure.
But, well, thank you for having me on, Jason. It was wonderful. And I really enjoyed the conversation.
Likewise. Thanks so much for sharing about your work.
All right. Take care, Jason.
You too. I'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Jay, thanks for having that conversation. It's really important, even for me as somebody who interacts with agents on a regular basis, to have the opportunity to see a longer, more thought out, nuanced conversation about why it is that someone chooses to be an agent and what their day looks like. So many of my emails are just essentially polite form letters going back and forth between two people. And it's very efficient and business-oriented language. It's always nice to see the human being behind the agent. And that's an important reminder too, that this industry is full of people who love books, who love to read, who are not only doing big book deals all day long, but are reading places, reading online places where they can find new clients and find new talent, be impressed with story. And, you know, she talked about reading Plowshares and some other places. And it's really cool to like see and hear a fairly large portrait of what it is that she's doing. So thank you for doing that.
My pleasure. And I had the same experience. It was great for me to hear about all that and to have the opportunity to develop a better understanding. And your point about this, the people who really care about books, it really is a reflection of the culture. I was particularly struck by her response when I asked her about books that she was particularly proud of, that, you know, the role that she had played in getting those books into the world. And, you know, her answer wasn't just like, oh, this was a huge deal, or this was a beautifully written book. But these are projects that both have the ability both to reflect and to contribute to changing attitudes towards making the world a better place, at the risk of trotting out an overused phrase. But sometimes that's just what it means. That's just what some people are trying to do.
Right. And that is our mission here at Collaborist, is to help people identify and tell those stories, because we do recognize the power they have in making a better world.
The books that she mentioned, we will put those titles in the show notes, and they will also be in our shop at bookshop.org. You can link to there and buy it. Well, one of them was out. The other one, she said, is forthcoming this summer, but we will add that as it comes out. And we'll list some of the journals that she mentioned. Those are, hearing that from her, certainly, I as I mentioned to her, I suffer from literary journal overwhelm. So to hear what she thinks are her favorite. And of course, I'm biased towards her because she's my agent and she embraced my manuscript wholeheartedly. But it's great. It's great to hear where someone like her is looking for up and coming writers for emerging fiction.
And as Jason mentioned, buying books from our storefront on bookshop.org is a great way to support Collaborist in a very passive way. We'll receive whatever kind of commission there is by pointing you that way. And we thank you for all of your support. We also encourage you to follow us on social media, and wherever you get your podcasts, be sure to rate and review Collaboracast. And I don't have anything else for this week. Do you, Jay?
I don't. We'll see you next week. First story.
For community, Collaborist. All right. But that was so bad, but we'll just leave that in. I'll see you later, man.
Take care.